Had the Warren Commission enlisted Dallas police and citizens to identify more of those present in the plaza and depository while their memories were fresh, they might have secured many more reliable accounts from every perspective in the plaza that could have enabled the commission and the public to weigh the preponderance of the evidence. And it might have been able to diminish the number of individuals who turned up years later with dramatic but questionable narratives about the assassination. As one person we interviewed said, if everyone who claimed to have been in Dealey Plaza was actually there, you could fill the Rose Bowl. The glaring inadequacies of the Warren Commission do not automatically mean that the commission erred in fingering Oswald as the lone gunman. Much testimony supports the commission viewpoint. One thing is certain. Today, it is difficult to separate fact from fiction when dealing with eyewitness accounts on November 22nd. Human beings notice different things during a crisis, and they see only a small part of the whole. They also tend to confuse media reports and the stories of other eyewitnesses with what they actually saw or heard. The result is a hodgepodge of truths, half-truths, blatant falsehoods, and sensational embellishments. A fair investigation can only reach a truthful conclusion once all the relevant testimony has been considered and compared. That the Warren Commission failed to do so is obvious to any unbiased investigator in the days, weeks, and months that followed November 22nd. The trail at that time was hot. Memories were at their sharpest. The commission had the strong backing of Congress and the country. Whatever money and staff were needed to produce a thorough report would have been forthcoming had they asked. While impatient, the public would have been willing to give the investigators the time they required to produce complete answers. Instead, many critical witnesses were overlooked. Many paths were not taken. Many tips not pursued, and a political schedule, not an investigator's timetable, determined the release date of the commission report. Those responsible for these decisions would say the nation needed to move on. Yet the irony of the commission's rushed and pre-digested report is that the nation was caught in a time warp for years. So instead of shutting the door on cynical and destructive assassination speculation, the Warren Commission actually maximized the opportunities for it. Countless books, television specials, newspaper articles, internet sites claim to know the precise truth about the assassination. The mafia did it. The CIA did it. No, it was anti-Castro Cubans. No, it was pro-Castro Cubans. It was Lyndon Johnson. The Secret Service did it. The Soviets were behind it. Texas oil millionaires paid for it. All of these theories have been proposed. There isn't time here. There wouldn't be time in a year-long course to cover all of the many theories that have emerged over the last 50 years. But I do want to discuss a few of the more prominent and pervasive theories that have been put forward. For a more complete list and more extensive coverage of the major theories, you need to consult the Kennedy Half Century. The suggestion that Lyndon Johnson was involved in the murder of his predecessor shocks almost anyone. But more than a few assassination researchers have put forward the theory that Lyndon Johnson was a willing co-conspirator in the killing of his predecessor, or at the very least, had prior knowledge that something was afoot. The linchpin of this conjecture is the belief that Johnson was far more amenable than JFK to the plans of the military, the defense industry, and the CIA to escalate in Vietnam. Now, Johnson lusted after the White House. That's obvious. He'd run for the Democratic nomination against Kennedy in 1960. He regarded John Kennedy as a lightweight in the Senate. He hated Robert Kennedy. That was his enemy. Their personal dislike was intense. They could barely contain it. Johnson believed that he'd been ill-treated as vice president to a certain degree, that his talents had been underutilized, that his influence had been marginalized by the Kennedy inner circle that called him Uncle Cornpone. He may even have thought that Kennedy might have dropped him from the ticket in 1964, or was going to do so. Anyone who has studied Johnson's career has got to acknowledge that for all of his intelligence and dazzling legislative and strategic skills, he was an exceptionally devious individual, and he was capable of great cruelty, even to those personally and professionally close to him. Most were quick to note that President Kennedy had been murdered in LBJ's Texas. Kennedy had gone there mainly to assist in brokering a truce in Democratic factional infighting, in which Johnson was a key player. Some friends and advisors, aware of the harsh treatment that had greeted United Nations Ambassador Adlai Stevenson in Dallas, he had been spat upon in that city 1 month earlier, wanted Kennedy to cancel the Dallas part of the Texas trip. Johnson's ascension to ultimate power, thanks to Kennedy's death in LBJ State, seemed awfully suspicious and mighty convenient. Kennedy loyalists quickly made the obvious connections, including Evelyn Lincoln, who was JFK's personal and close White House secretary, and she made it only a couple of hours after the assassination. Mrs. Lincoln was with Kennedy in Dallas. She flew back to Washington aboard Air Force One with LBJ and the president's body. During the flight, Evelyn Lincoln compiled a list of people and groups that she thought might have been responsible for the president's death. At the very top of her list was the name Lyndon. Yet one of Johnson's comments made during the flight, reflecting his fear of a possible conspiracy involving enemies of the United States, has to cast some doubt on Lincoln's assertion. Quote, "I wonder if the missiles are flying," he told his aide, Bill Moyers, who had asked him what was on his mind. Moreover, according to a key eyewitness, General Godfrey McHugh, who was very close to President Kennedy, the new president, Lyndon Johnson, was not as calm on Air Force One as one might have hoped, at least for a time. McHugh reported that he walked in on the toilet, quote, "and in the powder room, there was hiding with the curtain closed Lyndon Johnson, saying, 'They're going to get us all. It's a plot. It's a plot. It's going to get us all.' He was hysterical," said General McHugh, "sitting down on the John there alone in this thing." Conspiracy theorists claim they know why Johnson would have risked his career and even his life if he'd been accused of murder. By the autumn of 1963, rumors were circulating widely that LBJ would be dropped from the 1964 ticket. On the very day Kennedy died, the Dallas Morning News announced that Nixon predicts JFK may drop Johnson. That was a headline. Evelyn Lincoln also claimed years later that she had discussed with President Kennedy his 1964 vice presidential plans shortly before the Dallas trip. And Kennedy had told her, she claimed, that he had decided to drop LBJ and substitute North Carolina Governor Terry Sanford. Johnson had superb political antennae and lots of friends, so if JFK's intention was to replace him, he very possibly could have known that his days as the man a heartbeat away from the Oval Office were numbered. The problem with this scenario is there is not a shred of real evidence, the kind that would survive under competent cross-examination in a courtroom. Top Kennedy aides have insisted that the Kennedy-Johnson ticket would have been kept intact for the 1964 campaign. Jackie Kennedy also confirmed her husband's intention to keep LBJ as his running mate. Texas was still a critical state for John Kennedy, and it was in the throes of party factionalism and realignment that would have been made much worse if Johnson were dumped from the ticket. And many ask why President Kennedy would even go to Texas on a fence-mending mission if he secretly knew that he was going to be changing his re-election ticket, that is, dropping Johnson in a few months. Now look, Johnson arguably had the means and the motive and the opportunity to kill Kennedy. But so did dozens, if not hundreds, of other individuals and groups. And during the 5 decades since November 22, 1963, Lyndon Johnson's involvement is nothing more than conjecture, with no proof even of real smoke, much less fire. It's more like a misty fog generated by the need to find a larger-than-life villain to explain the great evil that ended a promising leader's life. Another area of controversy concerns the protection accorded to President Kennedy. This much is obvious. The federal agencies that were supposed to protect him failed at one, maybe the most fundamental responsibility. And then they tried to paper over their mistakes. The FBI destroyed evidence, and they assembled a self-serving report. The CIA withheld crucial information from the public, the press, and the Warren Commission for decades, and indeed may still be doing so. The Secret Service fell short in two ways. The agents designated to protect Kennedy's life were unable to accomplish the paramount mission of the Secret Service. And the administrative leadership of the Secret Service and its parent Treasury Department had not made an aggressive case for more agents. They'd not made the case for stricter standards to guard the president when he was outside the safe confines of the White House bubble. The individual agents are the least culpable, even though no group has blamed itself more. These men were shockingly overworked and overextended, almost beyond human endurance at times. The agents were also too few in number to do the job fully. They were kept too far away from the president to help in the kind of split-second attack that occurred in 1963. Their supervisors knew the dangers for years, yet nothing was done to stop a tragedy that was just waiting to happen. In combination, the Secret Service errors and the lack of better protection were fatal to John Kennedy. The service didn't even have Lee Harvey Oswald on any of its watch lists. Let's be clear, in the early 1960s, a person such as Oswald, despite having been a defector and having demonstrated hostility toward the United States and its leadership, could easily escape notice because he had not specifically telegraphed his intentions about hurting the president directly. In practice, the Secret Service depended heavily on regional law enforcement to provide them with the names of dangerous local residents. This was barely a safety net at all, and the Secret Service knew it, which is one of the reasons agents were always nervous during presidential trips outside Washington. As is too often the case, a monumental tragedy was needed to produce common sense reforms in presidential safety. After November 22nd, the Secret Service tightened protection in ways that should have been evident well before President Kennedy's murder. Today, it seems obvious that the president should not ride in an open convertible, nor should the motorcade route be broadcast and printed in newspapers as it was for 3 days prior to November 22, 1963, especially when tall buildings are all around and there are open windows everywhere. But to stop there misses the point entirely. When the route is released and publicized by any individual or group, it's then the responsibility of the Secret Service to make safe the path. The purpose of a motorcade is to enable a president to be seen. Why hadn't the agency provided in Dallas what in modern times would be considered a minimal level of security? Agents have claimed since that it was almost impossible to inspect buildings during presidential visits because of the shortage of time and manpower. This argues for more time and manpower, not a suspension of precautions. 50 years ago, the Secret Service already had precise procedures for inspecting buildings and making them secure in Washington during inaugural parades and events for visiting dignitaries. I've detailed this in the book, The Kennedy Half Century. Why were these requirements in effect only for special D.C. events? Why weren't they even more essential for road trips where the locales and threats might be less well-defined, less known in advance, especially when the president is sitting in an open car with nothing to stop bullets fired from any direction at him? Looking back, it's mind-boggling how naive and some would say lax the Secret Service was about presidential security in 1963. And it wasn't just the Secret Service. it was the presidential staff, maybe it was all of us. We didn't believe it could happen here. It's happened so often in American history. We were forewarned. Even during Kennedy's term, there were so many threats. Presidents were permitted to ride in long motorcades past tall buildings with hundreds of open windows, any one of which could have hidden an assassin. This was a disaster waiting to happen, and it was no secret. Just about everyone in authority at the time knew it and worried about it. At the height of the Cold War, most Americans were instinctively anti-Castro, recognizing the dangers of a communist state just 90 miles from America's southernmost shore in Florida. The military and the CIA had begun extensive planning to oust Castro during the Eisenhower administration, and one of President Kennedy's first major decisions was to go forward with the U.S.-backed invasion of Cuban exiles in April 1961. After the disaster of the Bay of Pigs, a chastened JFK and his brother Robert became obsessed with deposing Castro. RFK created a major program of subterfuge and disruption known as Operation Mongoose to bring about Castro's downfall. The Kennedys authorized the CIA to do whatever was necessary to engineer a coup d'etat in Cuba. This led to serious assassination efforts, but also cartoonish schemes such as exploding cigars, since Castro was addicted to the tobacco leaf. The CIA even worked with mafia chieftains to arrange for Castro's demise. Political bedfellows were rarely stranger than in those days, but La Cosa Nostra, another name for the mafia, had lost many millions of dollars when the previous dictator of Cuba, Batista, had fallen to Castro. The Cuban expatriates in South Florida were willing partners. They wanted to retake Cuba. Meanwhile, despite his disillusionment with the Soviet Union and his return to the United States, Oswald made contact with the local Russian diaspora in Fort Worth, Texas. Oswald had personal reasons for doing so. His wife Marina was homesick, she didn't speak much English, and Lee was now used to Slavic people and their ways. Soon Oswald became friends with a peripatetic baron named George de Morenschild, whose life sounds like something out of a James Bond novel. De Morenschild's father, a wealthy Russian nobleman, managed to escape from a Soviet prison where he was sent after denouncing the Bolshevik Revolution. He then moved his family from Minsk to a pasha state in Poland, where George spent his youth. While still in his 20s, George left Europe to tour the United States and managed to become friendly with some of America's East Coast elites, including a family named Bouvier, whose daughter Jacqueline would one day become First Lady, and another family named Bush. George H.W. Bush's nephew roomed with de Morenschild at Phillips Academy. In the years that followed, de Morenschild became involved in intelligence operations. During World War II, he gathered information on pro-German activity in the United States for the French. There are allegations that he was spying for the Nazis at the same time, but these have never been proven. In 1942, he shared a house with a senior naval officer and a British intelligence agent in Washington, and he offered his services to the Office of Strategic Services. That's the predecessor to the CIA. But they turned him down because of the double agent rumor. During the 1950s, de Morenschild worked for the International Cooperation Administration, which was nothing more than a CIA-sponsored subsidiary for the Agency for International Development. In the early 1960s, while touring Central America and the Caribbean, he was photographed with the American ambassador to Costa Rica. In addition, de Morenschild and his wife visited Guatemala, which was a strategic launching site for CIA-backed Cuban exiles during Bay of Pigs. Some think the CIA, which at times almost certainly had some sort of relationship with de Morenschild, used him to make contact with Oswald. The Baron himself, however, denied the connection. He insisted that, quote, no government would be stupid enough to trust Lee with anything important, unquote. The full truth is elusive, but de Morenschild's acquaintance with Lee Oswald is curious. For someone dismissed as an obvious loser of little consequence, Lee Harvey Oswald kept popping up in the company of very well-connected individuals. Concluded that Ruby had impulsively killed Oswald in a fit of anger. But there were others who saw the potential for a plot with more sinister and far-reaching motives. Many mafia kingpins loathed the Kennedys, mainly because RFK went after organized crime with a vengeance once he became Attorney General. He raised the number of mob convictions from 35 in 1960 to 288 in 1963. Did Bobby Kennedy's aggressive tactics represent a betrayal of a deal between JFK's father, Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., and the mob? Yes, it's not as outrageous as it sounds. Joseph Kennedy's, that is, Robert and John's father, had ties of some sort to organized crime, allegedly dating back to his days as a bootlegger during Prohibition, though others have challenged that suggestion. Shortly before the 1960 election, Joseph Kennedy was said to have promised Chicago mafiosa boss Sam Giancana access to the Oval Office in return for intervening with another mobster, Frank Costello, who had threatened to kill Joseph over a property dispute. The elder Kennedy was said to have made a deal with Giancana that if Giancana would protect him from Costello, he would see to it that Giancana had some access to the White House and the president. According to some published sources, Giancana agreed to the deal and convinced Costello to take Joe Kennedy off his hit list. Even before this incident, Giancana had apparently helped JFK by distributing cash to buy endorsements and votes during the critical West Virginia Democratic primary election in May 1960. The intermediary for the Kennedy-Giancana joint ventures was none other than singer Frank Sinatra. But the Kennedys turned on Giancana once they were in the White House, and Sinatra himself had to work hard to deflect the mobster's wrath at Sinatra on account of the Kennedys' unfaithfulness. The American public has been conditioned by the media and Hollywood to believe that the mafia is a well-oiled killing machine that can take down anyone. Author Mark North has accused FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, in effect, of being a silent accomplice to the assassination. In one of his books, Act of Treason, North argues that Hoover knew about a mafia plot to kill JFK, but says Hoover did nothing about it for two reasons. First, Hoover thought of Kennedy as indecisive and immoral because of Kennedy's extramarital affairs. And second, because JFK had made it known that he did not intend to keep Hoover in a second term. This second argument, especially in light of the first, is weak. While Kennedy would no doubt have preferred someone other than Hoover as FBI director, Hoover had cleverly accumulated evidence of JFK's infidelities and had made certain the Kennedys were aware of it. This provided him with an unusual form of job security. North claims that the overwhelming body of evidence points to the New Orleans mob boss Carlos Marcello as the person who masterminded the assassination. By the fall of 1962, Marcello was facing a federal indictment, possible deportation, and relentless attacks from Bobby Kennedy's Justice Department. Marcello reportedly believed that his problems would be solved by getting rid of President Kennedy and replacing him with President Johnson. It was common knowledge, North wrote, that LBJ had no interest in pursuing the mafia. FBI informers and pre-November 22nd eavesdropping had yielded a couple of clues that mob godfathers had drawn a bead on JFK. The assassination researcher Lamar Waldron has asserted, for example, that Marcello met with three men on the mobster's estate outside New Orleans in 1962 to lay out assassination plans. In the meeting, Waldron asserts that Marcello, quote, referred to President Kennedy as a dog, with his brother Robert being the tail. The dog, he said, will keep biting you if you only cut off its tail. In other words, Marcello believed he needed to kill JFK in order to neutralize Bobby. The House Committee on Assassinations, Robert Blakey, also believes Marcello and Santo Traficante, the mob don of Southern Florida, were the brains behind the Kennedy murder. In 1979, the same year the House Committee on Assassinations would issue an official government report asserting that Kennedy was killed by conspiracy, Marcello told an undercover FBI agent that he had known Oswald's uncle and knew that Lee Harvey Oswald worked for his uncle's gambling operation. Marcello and Trafficante made confessions shortly before they passed away. Marcello also told a fellow prison inmate that he had been introduced to Lee Oswald and had personally helped Jack Ruby get set up in the bar business. Whether every detail is true and accurate, two important points are clearly documented. The Kennedys had done a great deal to upset numerous mafia bosses, and the FBI had specific knowledge of a mafia interest in assassinating President Kennedy. There was both motive and means. The lack of swift and decisive action once these threats became known to the FBI is disturbing and raises legitimate questions about whether the FBI played a role, deliberate or not, in the murder of President Kennedy. The odds are they did not. You have to have specific evidence to make a charge this substantial and this damaging.